a summer of astronomy and books that are out of this world. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. With warmer weather and more free time for some, summer is a time to relax, unwind, and to stargaze. From meteor showers to spotting Mars, there's a lot happening in our skies. We'll speak with Seth Mayo from the Daytona Beach Museum of Arts and Sciences about these astronomical events and how you can view some astronomy with just your eyes. Then catching up on that to-be-read list, well, how about a book about America's space history, from the creation of NASA to space shuttle missions? We'll speak with authors Emily Carney and Bruce McCandless III about that book, Starbound, A Beginner's Guide to the American Space Program, from Goddard's rockets to Goldilocks planets and everything in between. Summer of Space, that's ahead on Are We There Yet? This summer, there are several cosmic events and planets that you can see right in your own backyard. From a glimpse at some of our neighboring planets to meteor showers, you don't need to be an astronomer to get excited about observing our skies. Looking for something to do this summer? Seth Mayo, the curator of astronomy at the Lohmann Planetarium at the Daytona Beach Museum of Arts and Sciences, says observing the skies is one way to spend your free time. From backyard telescopes to journeying to your local planetarium, there's a ton of astronomical events you can take part of over the next few months. Here to talk more about exactly what you can see in the stars and how best to view these cosmic events is Seth Mayo. Seth, welcome back to the show.
Great to be on here. Thanks.
So there's a lot to do when it comes to the skies, and folks may have some extra time on their hands with these summer months and school being out. So you're here to give us the rundown. But first, let's talk about some of the things that we can see in the sky this time of year. Are we able to see some planets?
So right now, we have Mars still in the sky in the west at the moment. Mars was really bright at the beginning of the year as we were reached its closest approach to that planet. And now that we've swung a little farther away from it now in our orbit, it is a little bit dimmer, but it's still shining as little kind of red non-twinkling star in the west. So Mars right now in the evening is your best planet to see at the moment. It is getting a little bit lower in the sky over time in the west. Right now it's sitting inside the great spring constellation of Leo the Lion. So that's a good place to start for planets. If for those early morning risers though, you look out to the east just before the sun rises, you might have a chance to spot Saturn. That's actually will be quite high in the morning right now. It's eventually going to make its way into the evening sky later in kind of midsummer. But the really bright beacon for planets in the sky right now is Venus in the morning. So for those that take walks in the morning or walk your dog or something, you look up in the east in the morning, you might see before the sun rises, bright Venus, which, as many folks know, is the brightest planet you can see in the sky, commonly called either the evening or morning star, even though it's not a star. It shines so, so bright, like a very bright star in our night sky. So right now, those are nice. Jupiter will rise again. Jupiter was great earlier in the year, but for the summer, you have to wait till later in the summer for Jupiter to start rising again in the morning. So that's something to look forward to. And also, Mercury will make a little peak by the end of June and into early July as well in the west, just below Mars. But Mercury doesn't usually spend too much time above the sun since it moves so quickly.
You mentioned you look for the non-twinkling stars, right? That's the best way to spot these planets with the naked eye?
That's right, Brendan. So that's what I usually tell folks in the planetarium or just when I'm stargazing with others is that look for those non-twinkling looking objects. So stars twinkle because of our atmosphere. We call it scintillation. And atmosphere is wavy and it changes and moves. And starlight comes from objects that are very, 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 of course, far away. Planets are much closer. The light, the reflected light from planets is not affected by our atmosphere as much, so they can have a very steady glow, especially the bright ones like Venus or Jupiter and Saturn, and also Mars. When Mars is very, very bright, too, you notice that non-twinkling nature of it. And Mars is special because it also glows a little red, being the red planet. Non-twinkling objects like planets kind of stand themselves apart from stars that are nearby.
So you can see them, as I like to observe in my backyard, but if you're lucky enough to have a telescope, you should be able to get some pretty nice views of these planets, right? Especially Saturn, and to see its rings, right?
That's right. So yeah, Saturn right now, you got to stay up real late or get really early in the morning. But if you do, if you're up at the right time and you point a telescope at Saturn, amazing. To see the rings with your own eyes has been great. Saturn's rings have actually been more edge on to us lately. And so they look more flat to us. But that makes it a little more unique than usual because normally the rings are plain as tilted towards us in some way. Or sometimes away from us. But right now it is tilted kind of edge onto us. So the rings look more flat, but still interesting. And then sometimes you see what look like little stars around those planets like Saturn or Jupiter, but they're moons. You know, Saturn now has over, I think, 240 moons, and the number keeps rising, discovered moons, but you can see a handful of them around Saturn and Jupiter. You can see famously the large Galilean moons when Jupiter rises again in the morning in late summer. So telescopes are a great way to not just see the planets themselves, but see things around them, the systems around these planets.
You know, I didn't even think that our perspective of the rings would change, but I guess, you know, these orbits are so dynamic that it does change. This is a really unique opportunity to see Saturn in a completely different light.
Yeah, that's right. You know, our solar system is not perfect, and there, you know, things sometimes are tilted differently versus other things. Planets have slightly different tilts, their orbits compared to other planets, and sometimes those planes will cross and you'll get all sorts of interesting things occurring, like the ring planes of Saturn sort of disappearing, you know, or the ring plane is edge on to us.
Seth, let's talk about something that's happening a little bit later this summer. We've got a meteor shower, right?
Yeah, so we have a couple smaller meteor showers going on. Right now, the Boötid's a very small one in late June. We have the Southern Delta Aquarids meteor shower in late July. Those are rather small, don't give off a lot. The really big one you find in the summer are the Perseid meteor showers. Now, sometimes when you hear the names, you'll hear Perseid or Aquarid. Those are the names of the constellations where the radiant sits, okay? And that's the point where the meteors stream from. You don't need to actually be looking at the radiant or those constellations. You just know that if you track those meteors, be coming from that spot in the sky. So for the Perseids in particular, you're going through a debris trail of these objects, these little rocky, icy bits, and they can stream through our atmosphere. They hit our atmosphere at tremendous speed. They light up, and sometimes we call them shooting stars, otherwise known as meteors. They can sometimes create these beautiful trails across the sky. Now, the thing is, you need to be in a very dark location to see them, or away from, you know, light pollution, or have good weather. And so you got to kind of situate yourself in the right place. And a lot of times the morning is the best time. Getting up before the sun rises is the best time. For the Perseids, that's always happening in late or mid to late August, some that kind of time frame when that occurs. Actually, it occurs for the entire month, but like the peak is mid-August for the Perseids. The unfortunate side of it for this showing, if you want to call it that, is that the moon will be rather large in the sky. And so you do have to contend with the moon's light, the reflected light from the moon. It can make meteors a little harder to see. So that's why getting to a dark place without the moon out is the best way to view them. But you never know. I tell people, even if the moon's out and it's predicted to be not the best viewing, a showing for the Perseids, still maybe check out a night or two around the peak of this meteor shower, because you might catch one or two meteors, or what we call fireballs, which are the bright ones that cross our sky. So the Perseids are the big one for the summertime, and that usually occurs in mid-August.
Do we have to worry about them? You're saying that our planet is passing through this debris and they're fiery, you know, or do we have to worry about these things causing any harm here on Earth?
You know, what's fun to think about, maybe it sounds a little scary at first, is that there are tons of debris that are entering our atmosphere every single day, every single night. But fortunately, that debris from the leftover bits from the early solar system is stuff that is really small, you know, grains of dust kinds of sizes. Typically, you'll find some that are a little larger here and there, but typically little grains. And most of them are burning up in the atmosphere before they actually hit the ground. Majority of them. Occasionally, you might get a meteor, an object, a larger piece of rock making its way to the ground. But think about what covers most of Earth is water. So most of the time, these things are hitting the water or a remote part of the land of Earth, right? But most of these objects, the majority of them streaming into our atmosphere for meteor showers or just happening all the time, are burning up in our atmosphere.
Okay, that's good to know. And I feel a little bit safer after hearing that. So I appreciate that, Seth. So
for sure, no problem.
Let's talk about some other things folks can do this summer to stay astronomically in the know. You mentioned right before we got on this interview that there are some observatories across the globe that are actually streaming their observations, and you can jump in and see that. What are some of the opportunities out there for us to look at really, really big telescopes without having to have a really, really big telescope in our backyard?
One really great observatory that's now starting to observe the universe is something called the Varisi Rubin Observatory. It's in Chile, and this is a new telescope, 8.4 meter a diameter mirror in this telescope. It's a pretty big one in one of the mountaintops in Chile, where a lot of the telescopes sit, the largest of those. And the telescope has a really big camera on it, and it happens to be the largest camera ever built. And it's going to take a survey of the southern hemisphere sky over the course of 10 years. It's actually going to map the entire sky every 3 or 4 days. It gets 20 terabytes of data every day that they'll stream back from this telescope on this mountaintop. And that data, a lot of that is published online for people to access, which is great. A lot of these programs, telescope programs, these missions, they're democratizing them. They're allowing more people to tap into the imagery and not holding tight to the content, which is great. And so from the Rubin Observatory, or from especially the James Webb Space Telescope or other observatories like that are major and they're huge and they're showing us the universe, they do publish a lot of the even raw images online for anyone to access. And so the new one, again, this year is the Rubin Observatory that's just opening up and now peering at the sky, a whole giant area of the sky. And as they bring those images to the public, people can look at these images, process them. They can maybe just make discoveries. And so there have been discoveries made by citizen scientists looking at images that are published, you know, made readily available to the world.
I'm looking at their first look images right now, and the cosmic treasure chest is just incredible. And there's this beautiful video that walks you through it. So definitely check that out. And you're saying there's plenty of more images to come now that it's taking observations, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, they're releasing images constantly from this. It will be taking images every single night from where it's located in South America. And we'll see more and more over the course of these 10 years and even probably beyond as well. And the images are so high resolution. Of course, it's like having a new phone with a new camera, right? Your pictures come out even better. The resolution's better. Well, now this camera is a 3200 megapixel camera. And so it is unbelievable in terms of resolution and resolving power and clarity, really kind of upgrading that resolution, allowing you to really peer deep into the universe at unprecedented detail that anyone can access.
And finally, Seth, there are other ways for folks to take in the universe at their neighborhood planetarium. There's yours in Daytona Beach. I've also been to the one in our friends at Seminole State College. Orlando Science Center here in Central Florida has them, but there's probably a planetarium in somebody's neighborhood across the country, right? Make the case for why people should go and visit their planetarium this summer.
Oh, yes. I love that question. We're at our own planetarium here at the Loma Planetarium at the Museum of Arts and Sciences in Daytona, and we run shows every day, and we always make sure to have a show that's about the night sky. The Sky Tonight Live is a daily program where we share the wonders of the universe, and I can speak about friends and colleagues at other planetariums around the country that do the same thing. They show you the universe in this immersive way, wrapped around you, and it makes you wonder and makes you think about the universe and makes you appreciate it, connects you with nature, because the universe is nature. And so if you can find your local neighborhood planetarium, definitely go check out a show. You'll get the chance to really learn so much about our universe, about even Earth itself, and you'll always see something really cool and special. And we always hope, any planetarium hopes, that you can step outside the planetarium and go outside and check out these things for yourself too, because that real curiosity starts with you doing it yourself. Planetariums are a gateway to that curiosity.
Seth, thank you so much for giving us the rundown on what's happening in the skies this summer. Seth, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
That was Seth Mayo, the curator of astronomy at the Lohmann Planetarium at Daytona Beach Museum of Arts and Sciences. Still to come, a deep dive into America's space history.
There's so many different perspectives on the space program. You can read Ed Gibson's book about solar science. You can read 500 pages that James Hansen wrote about Neil Armstrong. You can read about the first women astronauts. But, you know, the problem is that not that there's not information out there, there's maybe too much information out there. And so what we've tried to do is create a little narrative roadmap to the history of the space program.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Aside from stargazing and taking a trip to your local science museum, another way to relax this summer is to dive into books, especially space ones. And if you want to start reading about America's space exploration, you can start with Starbound. The book, Starbound, A Beginner's Guide to the American Space Program, from Goddard's Rockets to Goldilocks Planets and Everything in Between, takes readers to the beginning of how it all started and explains key events and facts that can help anyone understand our nation's space exploration history. We spoke with the co-authors of Starbound, Emily Carney and Bruce McCandless III, about their book back in December. Here's part of that conversation now. Emily, Bruce, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having us, Brendan. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Brendan. Glad to be here.
Thank you both. The book is Starbound, A Beginner's Guide to the American Space Program, from Goddard's Rockets to Goldilocks Planets and Everything in Between. Emily, this is quite a bit to cover. What was the motivation to write a book of this caliber?
Well, before we went through the whole publishing process, I just really wanted, a couple of years ago, I was like, man, I'd really like to write a book with somebody, but I wanted it to be sort of a collaborative effort because I needed somebody to hold me up to like the bargain, basically, because I was like, I'm never going to do this if I don't have somebody like breathing down my neck. I think I even made a post on Facebook like, hey, I'm interested in writing a book. I didn't expect anybody to respond. But Bruce was like, hey, I'm already working on something. Do you want to work on it with me? And I was like, heck yeah. And it was basically around the same time, a couple of years ago, Colin Burgess, who is the series editor for the Outward Odyssey series with University of Nebraska, which is our press, he came out with an excellent book about the Soviet space program, basically the history of the program. We didn't want to copy him, but we had sort of an idea, like, what if somebody wrote sort of a book that was analogous to it about the U.S. space program and what's going on now and what, you know, our history and stuff like that. So we got the idea for that and worked on the manuscript. And basically, we checked with University of Nebraska Press, like, hey, would you guys be interested in this? And they were. And really, the rest is history. So that's really it from my end. I really want to say Bruce and the press have been extraordinarily easy to work with. So I feel like I've been very blessed, this being my first actual book project. I've helped with a bunch of books and I've written a book chapter, but I've never actually had my name on the cover of one. I feel it's been extraordinarily easy to work with everybody. So,
and Bruce, you have quite a personal connection to the U.S. space program, do you not?
Well, I think so. My dad was employed by the space agency NASA for many years as an astronaut and flew on a couple of the shuttle missions. He was Bruce McCandless II, of course, and he's the guy you see in the jetpack in that famous photograph from STS-41B back in 1984.
A terrifying photo, I may add.
Yeah, terrifying and pretty memorable, as it seems like. Emily once told me that she had a poster of that image in her room growing up.
I did. I did have that, and I had Discovery. I think it was STS-41D. I had that poster as well. So yeah, I was a nerd. I didn't have a lot of boyfriends and stuff. So. I always say that, but I didn't, because it was like, oh God, she's a dork, you know? But yeah, I did have those on my bedroom wall.
So that's cool. Yeah, so he's one of those photographs, and he was also on the mission that deployed the Hubble Space Telescope in 1990. And that may turn out to be the more lasting scientific contribution of those two flights, but he was proud of both of them. And that's sort of my connection. I grew up down there in Houston near the Johnson Space Center and watched some of those flights go up and was sort of immersed in that culture for a while.
Was your father a storyteller? Is that how you got into telling stories?
He was not a storyteller. He was a fact guy. He was a facts and measurements and sometimes stinted the narrative, just the opposite. And writing the book, I was sometimes amazed by what I thought I knew but didn't actually know. So I had to go back and check all my facts and figures, whereas he was definitely a facts and figures kind of guy.
The book, it encompasses literally the entire history of the U.S. space program, but there is a focus on not just the facts and figures, as you mentioned, Bruce, but the cultural and societal context. Emily, why was that important to frame the U.S. space program through cultural and society?
I'm going to answer it through the lens of probably the chapter that I had the most input on, the 1970s chapter. That time was not a particularly fun time for the United States. And culturally, that decade has been maligned a lot. There was a lot of very crappy entertainment during the 1970s. The funny thing is, I didn't live through that decade, but Bruce has, and he's told me a little bit about it. You know, there were, like, even the movies were terrible, you know? So that was kind of a critically maligned decade on many levels. But, you know, also politically, you had things like, you know, Watergate. You had a lot of factors like inflation and kind of a very difficult decade for the United States. And during spaceflight, especially human spaceflight that decade, you had the end of Apollo, and then you had Skylab, which was really not viewed very favorably at the time, just because I think a lot of people saw it as, oh, we're just going to Earth orbit. We're not going to the moon. People did not pay attention to that. And then you had Apollo Soyuz, which was kind of a nice little, you know, coda to the Apollo program. And then that was it. There was nothing until the space shuttle. And that decade was really viewed as like a stagnant time in space flight. And I think there were a lot of cultural references to the difficulty of that decade. It wasn't a very fun decade at the time. Yeah, so I think the cultural notes really sort of illuminate, okay, what kind of time was this? You know, you put it in contrast to the 50s and 60s where, you know, cars look like rockets. Things were very sort of future looking. There were songs about space. You know, people were just nuts about spaceflight during that time. Whereas by the 70s, the glamour had worn off, so to speak. So we felt it was very important to put those cultural references in just to illuminate people's attitude to spaceflight during that time and sort of the general attitude people had to spaceflight during those times. I can say on my half, years ago, I found this great memo from Phil Chapman, former U.S. astronaut. He was actually Australian born, but he was talking about just after Apollo 11 landed and people were losing interest in spaceflight. And he really predicted sort of the malaise, the late President Carter, using a speech, he was really predicting what would happen during the decade. So we really tried to capture that. I think we both felt, I can't speak for Bruce 100% because I'm not him, but I think I can say that we both felt it was important to sort of give a framework to what the decades were like. And we didn't want it to just be a rote sort of reciting of, you know, facts. Okay, this happened. Yay, we're done, you know?
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Emily Carney and Bruce McCandless III. They are the authors of Starbound, A Beginner's Guide to the American Space Program, from Goddard's Rockets to Goldilocks Planets and everything in between. Bruce, jumping off from what Emily said there about those consequential moments, those societal moments and pop culture moments in history that made big parts of the space program, is there a particular point in time that you think was the most consequential moment for the U.S. space program?
Well, I'm going to give you the obvious answer, and that is, yes, the most consequential moment was Apollo 11, specifically the instant Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon, and that was an encapsulation and sort of the zenith of our efforts in space up to that point, and they've served as a reminder and as a sort of goad, in a way, for our efforts now, because what we did was so remarkable that people have had a hard time becoming quite as enthusiastic ever since. So I think that that moment, both the point of pride and in some ways it haunts us, it was like a piece of the 21st century was grafted into the 20th century. And it was so amazing that we've had a hard time equaling it ever since. I'll echo Emily on the cultural point. I think there's 100 different ways to write about the space program. And we chose to approach it through sort of a cultural lens. Norman Mailer, when he was writing about the Apollo program back in the 60s, approached it through sort of a personal psychosexual lens. Margaret Weitkamp at the Smithsonian wrote about the space program in terms of artifacts, and including maybe even especially space toys. A guy named Walter McDougall wrote about the space program and its history through a socio-political lens. Friend Lauren Grush, a journalist, wrote about the six first female astronauts, and sort of focused her study of the space program by a feminist lens. So there's lots of ways to do it. Emily and I aren't scientists. Scientists would have written a much different book. We tend to look at ourselves as more cultural historians. So that's, you know, where we came from in this.
With that said, Emily, as Bruce mentioned, there's 100 different ways to write the book. You framed it through the social and cultural perspectives. Who's the audience for this book? Who is going to get the most out of the content of Starbound?
I hope everybody is the audience for Starbound. I really hope it's everybody. We tried to write it in a way that was accessible to all people, whether they are very new coming into spaceflight enthusiasm or diehards. Being, you know, the creator of Space Hipsters, you know, I often see in the group, there are people who come to the group with no knowledge about spaceflight. They're just becoming enthusiastic. Maybe they just saw a launch or something like that, and that's what got them interested. And they don't know a lot, and they're intimidated. you know, they come into the group and there's a lot of people who have a massive amount of expertise in the group. They're very intimidated by it and they might not ask questions. And, you know, that bothers me. I don't want that climate in the group. I want people to be comfortable asking questions. Well, why did this happen? Why did President Kennedy do this? Why did this event happen the way it did? And we kind of hope the book fills that void for people as well and just keeps them interested. You know, you don't have to be, I think Bruce just said this, you know, we're not coming at people as scientists or as like 100%. We are the sole expert on this. You know, we're coming to people as really enthusiasts ourselves. So we really hope we've made it accessible to everybody.
I mean, I think Emily's right. In fact, she just said something that kind of got me excited. And that is, there's so many different perspectives on the space program. I mean, you can read Ed Gibson's book about solar science. You can read 500 pages that James Hansen wrote about Neil Armstrong. You can read about the first women astronauts. The problem is that not that there's not information out there. There's maybe too much information out there. And so what we've tried to do is create a little narrative roadmap to the history of the space program that is simple enough for someone who's reasonably well-read and an intelligent person who's curious about things, who can sort of jump into this subject without feeling intimidated, certainly by the authors or the subject matter, hopefully. And so we hope we are really striking the fancy of a bunch of people out there.
If you want to read more about space this summer, check out our website for a list of books from authors we have featured on Are We There Yet? You can do that at cfpublic.org/space. And along with reading, this summer you can join the Central Florida Public Media family. We're aiming for 100 new monthly sustainers to support the independent news and programs you love. Become a sustainer and get a thank you gift like an umbrella or travel mug. Find out more at cfpublic.org. And thanks. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, the NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTYSpace. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show or you'd like to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is aretheyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet? It's a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Ashley Reap. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.